Hi, Anna.
Hi.
Oh, man, I feel so honored.
And there's my cat.
Oh, no.
He's standing right in front
of me. I'm seeing Anna's cat in my mind.
he's an enormous gray cat.
Man.
Hello. It's good to see you, or not see you.
So Anna Marie Cox is kind of a dynamo. She is a kind of multimedia legend in her own time. And she is gracing me with her kind of virtual presence. And, you know, do you want to...
Oh, the gracing goes both
ways. Do you want to introduce yourself, Anna?
Well, I am a recovering blogger. And I now hold a post at the Daily Beast, which is Tina Brown's...
You do that every day.
I'm actually really excited because it looks like I'm going to get a Senate Press Gallery pass in the name of the Daily Beast, which I love, and I'm actually considering, like, getting a fedora so I can wear, like, a press tag for the Daily Beast in my hat. And you?
I'm Raihan Salam. I am an editor at The Atlantic and a fellow at the New America Foundation, and I'm also a blogger for the American scene. The American scene, little known fact, is that it is actually funded by a shadowy international organization called CHAOS. The acronym of which is actually... But people often wonder, you know, kind of, you know, where do you get the money for bandwidth, et cetera? And it comes from the same place that Barack Obama's money came from, you know, kind of decades ago. Basically, we're both Soviet sleeper agents. So that's sort of just to kind of fill you in. I actually wasn't supposed to say that, but I'm not worried about anyone watching this.
You know, it's funny. I mean, we had talked about talking about the shoe guy.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, I don't know if you saw Conan O'Brien last night. Probably
no,
not.
Sadly.
You don't strike me as a network TV viewer. and I didn't either, but a friend of mine informed me that they had a segment on the guy that threw the shoe, and they implicated some other journalists in it, sort of like a grassy knoll style recreation, and one of the journalists was a good friend of mine, who I won't name, because he's hoping to get through this without, you know, much attention, but the funny part was he works for a not very well-known agency and or outlet, and so he was telling me this story about how he'd been, you know, working at the White House for 8 years, trying to get more access, trying to get his outlet more attention. And I was like, it finally paid off. You're all of that planning, 8 years to throw the shoe.
I'm just glad it wasn't a stiletto, because then
stiletto.
Oh yeah,
heel.
Exactly. Might have landed right in his eye. That would have been just terribly embarrassing.
That's right.
And
that's
painful.
Right. Someone asked me if I'd ever been tempted to throw a shoe at someone giving a press conference, and I said yes. But Sarah Palin probably would have thrown it right back.
I wonder. Like, I'm sort of fascinated by footwear in general. I mean, there's a young woman who went to my high school who was like incredibly kind of. She was very quiet, but she was, like, incredibly stylish, and sure enough, she went on to become a shoe designer. And she was interviewing to work at this company, and she was showing me some of their shoes. They literally had a pair of shoes with rims on them. And I was like, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. In the Depression, we won't see any more shoes with rims, probably. But I understand that you kind of are a little offended by the shoe tossing. You're not as delighted as much of the rest of, you know.
I find it, I mean, I think as viewers who have stuck with us this far know, I can find humor in the incident, definitely. And there's a lot to laugh about there. But I am simply reminded of how back in my college days when I was a young protester, believe it or not, I probably wasn't very good at it because I actually took very seriously the idea that the protest should be within sort of agreed upon rules. And I was upset when, like, we negotiated something with the administration to protest, to, like, have, like, a silent protest or something, and then people would, like, yell and take off their shirts and, like, throw up, you know, put up big banners. Because I was like, you know, we're here to make a
point. But you were a mathematician, so did you protest things like base 10 or...
Actually, no, that would be my father's style. I actually, the protest I'm thinking of specifically here is one that was at the University of Chicago Law School when Orrin Hatch came to speak. During the height of the Anita Hill
stuff. I see.
And we had agreed that we would do a silent protest during his speech, and some people got up and sort of rabble-roused, and I thought it ruined the whole thing. So there's part of me that's just like, you know, the shoe-thrower guy, and I realize it's funny, he threw a shoe, whatever, the president didn't get hurt, but I, for one, just on the president not getting hurt part, I'm glad he didn't get hurt, in part because, you know, I don't want Cheney serving out the rest of the Bush term. You know, I don't think the guy that threw the shoe wanted it. He could have he could have hurt the president. That'd give Cheney a chance to, you know, like, sell all of our souls to the devil or whatever it is he could do as president and not as vice president. Who knows what
his powers
are. I
like the idea of the shoe-throwing guy having a kind of 1% doctrine of his own, where we had a 1% chance of him badly, you know, hemorrhaging Bush's brain, you know, or something like that, you know, kind of would have prevented. I think that, I mean, my kind of take is the kind of totally predictable, glib neocon take on the shoe tossing, which is mm-hmm. that, you know, kind of the fact that Arabs are getting incredibly stoked about the shoe tosser, to me is just, you know, kind of like, well, you know, something might be redeemed from this whole enterprise after all.
Which is
mainly, I mean, sort of that, you know, Iraq, one can imagine Iraq having this kind of freewheeling, you know, kind of public life. You know, had you thrown a shoe at Saddam, you know, horribly bad things would have happened to you in all likelihood.
Well, except this guy did get beaten.
He did get beaten, and he wasn't killed.
And he got beaten on the floor of this press
conference. Cool at all. Not cool at all. And I
so,
think that, yeah.
I mean, there's no, what's yeah. the redeeming, where
well,
is
again,
the redeeming?
I mean, I'm sort of making an incredibly modest claim, I think, which is that, you know, kind of having a public life that, you know, kind of allows you to kind of not get executed in the wake of something like that, you know, kind of is like,
you're
baby
right,
steps.
They didn't kill
baby
the guy.
Steps, yeah.
That's what every journalist in America should remember.
But Anna, like, sort of just, you know, I think that it's, you know, I'm certainly not saying, hey, everything was great, wow, but it's just like sort of,
yeah.
is there something that we can sort of take away
Has
from this?
Has there been progress in Iraq? Yeah, I mean, sure, is the current situation in Iraq better than it was under Saddam? I think that I will agree with you that it is, but I think the question...
I don't think it's not obvious, and I think that, yeah.
Yeah, and the point that the guy that threw the shoe, I wish I could remember his name, would say is that, you know, it's not better because of the invasion.
I think that it's,
You know, it's the invasion was a incredibly, you know,
there's a grave danger of us kind of re-prosecuting the Iraq War. I mean, I think that,
yeah,
you know, my sort of just, you know...
That's what for Bush's memoir.
Yeah. Which will be a kind of a delightful read. One hopes they will be illustrated in the vein of kind of Goofus and Gallant or something like that.
My pet goat.
But I think that...
I think he's going to get the same illustrator as my pet goat.
I kind of belong to the camp of, you know, kind of, you know, a horrible, bungling mess, and I was one of these people, one of these kind of right-wingers who wanted Bush to lose in 2004, but then has mm-hmm. this kind of vague sense that, you know, like now that perhaps, you know, it was better that he won because he was able to kind of pursue this dramatic reversal, whereas had a Democrat been in office, it would have been very hard. The politics would have been much uglier. The right would have made it extremely difficult.
Well, that's definitely...
So I think it's complicated and weird and thorny, and I kind of don't even know how to think about it. But, I mean, I just do have the sense that, you know, this kind of historical disaster might have actually turned into this thing that could be a kind of good and constructive development, you know, for
well,
that
that's
part
very...
of the world. But.
That's very optimistic of you. I hope you're right. I mean, I'm not someone that goes around wishing that things get worse. I will point out that sort of the politics that we were discussing about, you know, maybe it's better that Bush got elected in 2004 so that it's because the politics would have been uglier or harder with the Democrat. I will say, however, that it's going to only a Democrat will be able to stay in Iraq.
Yeah, I absolutely.
Which is what's gonna happen.
Well, you know, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I find that a lot of my lefty, you know, comrades who, you know, kind of like 6 months ago would have been incredibly exercised by, you know, kind of what looks like the Obama foreign policy will likely be, are now a lot mm-hmm. more inclined to be restrained about it. And I think that, you know, the politics around that issue have become a lot more muted and, you know, one hopes more pragmatic. And I think that that's something that you saw, you know, even in the latter days of this administration. So, I mean, and whether that's a good or... I just kind of think that the really miserable thing about Iraq was that, you know, one party owned the war, and another
right.
sort of half of the country felt, you know, kind of enraged and alienated, and for a lot of very good reasons.
And then much, much more.
Yeah, and then, yeah, absolutely. And then I think that, you know, kind of the hope is that, well, now, you know, kind of a wider slice of the country will own our foreign policy, and that, you know, this will help, you know, kind of...
Yeah, well, it's going to be easier for Obama than it ever was for Bush. And I am one of the people that was happy that Susan Rice told the truth back in the day, but, you know, she said that he's going to have to reevaluate his options and we won't necessarily be out in 16 months. And I think that, you know, and that makes me happy. I don't know how many Obama supporters there are out there that actually are comfortable with that as well. My sense just from, you know, the internet is not a good place to go for, you know, a broad swath of society. But the pushback that, you know, our colleagues in the media are getting when they do things like suggest that Obama will not get out of Iraq is pretty extreme. which suggests to me that there are people, there are some true believers and purists out there. But, you know, Obama didn't get elected by true believers and purists. So I think most Americans are probably just, they just want confidence.
You were talking about your student protester days, and now, you know, it certainly sounds, you know, my impression is that, you know, while you consider yourself left of center, I mean, there's clearly a kind of streak of this, well, pragmatism is a kind of pretty vacuous word, I guess. But, I mean, I think that, you know, kind of, I certainly detect a kind of note of kind of sober pragmatism. How would you characterize your political... How would you characterize your political evolution, you know, over, say, the last decade? I mean, is it something that you've been very self-conscious about? Or, you know, kind of, and I imagine a lot of it has to do with just kind of responding to the disaster that's been, you know, the Bush years. But, you know, I'm curious.
Well, I don't know through the Bush years. I mean, the Bush years, if anything, probably would radicalize most people to the left. I think that my own experience has been influenced a lot by having worked in explicitly, you know, sort of liberal contexts. You know, one of my very first journalism jobs was at Mother Jones.
And how is she doing, by the way?
She's dancing at your revolution. That experience as something, you know, I've thought about it recently because a young Obama speechwriter, John Favreau, got in trouble.
Ah, yes, for tweaking the bosom.
For squeezing the fake bosom on a Facebook picture. Indeed. If it wasn't on Facebook, it should have been. And I recalled how when I worked at Mother Jones, we made some of the most awful, racist, and sexist, and homophobic jokes in the office because when you're, like, set upon by earnestness from all sides, that is a huge release, you know, because everyone knows you're also kidding. Like, you are sitting around making racist, sexist, homophobic jokes with other women, with people of color, with gay people. And you're doing it just to gain some sort of sense of perspective after having dealt with these people whose worldview is just so deadpan. And so I can imagine if I was working for Barack Obama, having to deal with the volunteers and whatnot, these people, bless their hearts. I probably would be squeezing a fake boob.
I've often thought about this. I mean, the way that, and this is something that, you know, kind of I'm extremely reluctant to name names, but I sort of feel like, you know, among sort of, again, you know, kind of people that I know on the left, I mean, I feel like there are people that I think of as the ironic left. And there are the people who I think of as the kind of unironic left. And I think that, you know, there is this weird two-way trade. There's definitely a kind of symbiosis between the two groups. But, I mean, I kind of feel like the kind of ironic left, and I guess I, you know, maybe belong to the ironic right, which I think is maybe primarily...
There's very few of the ironic right.
But I think it's sort of a lot of its kind of generational sensibility. But, I mean, I kind of, you know, because I'm projecting or because, you know, kind of not for any kind of good analytical reason, I think of the ironic left as being smarter, but also potentially... more nihilistic, and I kind of, you know, find it kind of instinctively more appealing. Yet, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, the people who are the epigones, the people that I think of as being, you know, kind of standard bearers of the ironic left, you know, their kind of army of followers are actually extremely earnest, and so there's a risk of kind of overinterpreting or underinterpreting things. And so it's just like
Yeah, there is. And actually, I would, you know, I think that's interesting because I think you're right. I think that, well, I think to be a follower is to be more earnest, for one thing. You know, like, people who are ironic are not good at following, which is why I was eventually made kind of uncomfortable and was uncomfortable with my career as a student professor.
Well, you were so charismatic, though. I think that there's a danger of you kind of having unthinking zombies who, you know, kind of are also kind of having strawberry blonde hair and, you know, kind of...
Right. Well, I mean, but I think, like, I mean, you know, I probably think that people like Rachel Maddow and, you know, John Stewart and Stephen Colbert, who I think I would name as ironic lefties, pretty obviously so, to name names.
I don't know about Stewart, but the other two I'll agree with you. I don't know about Stewart, but I'll agree with you on the other
two. You don't think he's ironic?
I actually think the other two strike me as very kind of sharp and bright, and I guess Stewart, I kind of just don't have as much faith in his wattage. Although, like, yeah, I mean, kind of in a way, but I guess I put the other two in a slightly kind of more elevated
names.
Right on.
And I think that they would probably not enjoy the company of their...
Wait a second, is Obama part of the ironic left, in your view?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think he is.
I agree with you, and I think it's really weird. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine who, you know, kind of like you.
And also, I think a lot of his staff was. Which is also
I agree. I think it's extremely strange, and they're of this kind of weird generation. But I was talking to a friend of mine who spent a lot of time in Hyde Park, and her, you know, kind of parents are kind of like ultra kind of lefties who, you know, think of Dick Durbin as their senator and think that Barack Obama, you know, when he was in the state senate, would make jokes about, you know, how Barack Obama... you know, you ask him, what do you think of, do you want a turkey sandwich? And he's like, some people like turkey sandwiches, and other people, but, you know, like, bracketing that, I actually do definitely think that he has this, comes from this kind of irony-steeped kind of universe, and as someone who's, like, you know, kind of very deft at dealing with people and can kind of be a listener and can absorb and what have you, but I think that, you know, it's this weird mix of qualities that kind of reflects his generation, or rather a generation a little bit younger than him. And, I mean, just the idea that he's going to have power, because I just, when I think of this generation and people like my sisters, I just think of people who are actually kind of uncomfortable with power. And I also think of the movie Singles, which has nothing to do with this at all, but, so, yeah, anyway.
No, he is the first generation.
Yeah, I mean, which is just wild. So, I mean, how do you think that's, you know, playing out? How do you think it will play out in terms of...
Well, I think it played out, actually, this is the thing, I think you can see it in their media strategy. It's one of the most cynical press operations in modern history. Right? I mean,
well, you know a lot more about than me.
Cynicism and irony are not too far apart, let's face it. And I think that the Obama press strategy was incredibly cynical and also sometimes self-consciously ironic. I was on a panel recently with an Obama staffer. And a McCain staffer, and we were talking about the treatment of that the campaigns gave the press, and I don't know why people are still shocked by this, that the McCain campaign was so much more open and in a way like more progressive. I just put my fingers up and did air quotes. You can't see, but you'll see when they play this back. Than the Obama people, and the Obama staffer laughed and was like, "That's right, we kidnapped you guys." And I had sort of forgotten about it. It was during the vice presidential stuff where. They had the press on the Obama plane and Obama was on the plane and then he suddenly got off and they sent the plane ahead. You know, they literally kidnapped the press. And he was laughing about it.
Wow,
you know?
That actually sounds really mean. I kind of feel like, I mean, it's a little, because, you know, there's, I feel like I have a weird relationship with Generation X because at least according to one of the books, I think it was like Howe and Strauss.
13th Man,
yeah, they
or whatever
claim
it was.
That it ends. So I was born December 29th, 1979. So, like, you know, kind of under their theory, I slide in as part of Generation X. But then there are others who claim, and also, like, I transferred colleges.
Oh, let's just go ahead and go back. It's a sensibility which I think spreads over. I think it has actually to do with, you know, whether or not you experienced, well, this is, you know, whether or not you experienced a depression, whether or not you experienced
a
war,
absolutely.
Whether or not, like, what are the things that shape your sensibility? And I think that something that you and I and Obama can say helped shape our political sensibility would be, for instance, at least the tail end of the Reagan years, right? And then also the Clinton presidency. That's probably the biggest influence on my political sensibility, from my understanding about how
that one thing that's interesting to me is just also the kind of arriving Obama generation, because, I mean, I think that, you know, in a bizarre set of circumstances having nothing to do with any, you know, kind of shrewdness on my part, I will suddenly become incredibly well-sourced in, like, a few weeks. And it's interesting because, like, I do think that, like,
can you share some? Because I'm going to be like, I
absolutely
have terrible stories.
They're actually all incredibly charming, too. But I think that, well, first of all, the one funny thing is that actually everyone expects that Washington is going to suddenly become much babelier, suddenly. Yeah, like foxier. Like all these kind of handsome men and women will kind of arrive.
God. No, they're still in politics.
That's a very good point. But I think that, like...
Although Jon Favreau...
Well, you know, we might disagree. But I think that it's interesting because I think there is a little bit of a difference because I sort of see the kind of organization kid generation being, like, different from Gen X in some respects. And I think that I kind of bridge because my sisters, I mean, they kind of gave me Jello Biafra tapes when I was in middle school. But then, you know, kind of, but then there's the kind of much kind of spunky, like, incredibly optimistic and also kind of somewhat leftier because, like, Generation X, like, maybe kind of the slice of it that we're exposed to is lefty, but so much of it in the country is not. And I think that it's going to be very interesting also because I've just been talking to friends constantly and unsurprisingly, like, you know, my, you know, people I know are over-concentrated in, like, academia and the law and other, you know, kind of boring professions. And they're just talking about the economic climate. So, like, we have this kind of weird political phase shift. But then there's also, like, the period when people in their late 20s are going to be, you know, theoretically going into the period of their life when you're, like, getting ready for your most productive prime years. And then suddenly, like, wow, all of the assumptions have blown up. And just, I wonder about, like, the counter-cyclical sensibility and what it's like, you know, living in, you know... because you kind of... Your generation, I mean, there was also the sense of kind of baby bust. There was this sense of, you know, kind of certainly the early 90s economic downturn, there was just kind of a mood of kind of general kind of decline and also a lot of contempt for the youth, I mean, I feel, in around that time. How do you think that, you know, this kind of shaped your trajectory and that of your, you know, cronies and allies and friends? And what do you see happening now?
I was going to get to the sort of the idea of the organization kid and the ironic lefty and Gen X.
Oh, yeah, let's weave it together.
And I think that what's interesting about the Obama team is that I think that a lot of them are kind of the organization kid, as in the hyper, the very attuned to success and, very belief in meritocracy and... Probably had parents who, you know, were incredibly nurturing, or thought they were being nurturing at least.
I'm just imagining like a 14-year-old wearing a pocket protector, suckling at a kind of false bosom, but that's not.
But I think that what's interesting about the people I know, at least in the Obama campaign, is that they're sort of a combination of that kind of like hyper successful, like hyper, you know, achievement, and also kind of ironic. And I think that's probably pretty rare, and that's probably why they're leaders in the Obama organization. And I think probably if you look at the 500,000 volunteers out there, I think you'll find them probably either a good share of them are probably the organization.
Do you think that is a good and healthy orientation? I mean, what you described?
The organization
in terms of the kind of elite leadership, I mean, that mix of kind of, you know, kind of meritocratic, you know, kind of ambition and drive plus a kind of... And how does the kind of irony kind of operationalize itself?
Well, I think the irony, I think I said before, I'm not kidding, I think that the irony operationalizes itself in an ability to manipulate, awareness about when you're being manipulative, but also being...
To me, like, the thing is, you know,
And I think I think we've seen that in this transition period. You know, I think that Obama's very...
I always think about people outsmarting themselves. I mean, I kind of think of people that I know, people that I'm related to, outsmarting therapy.
Well, by picking Hillary Clinton, that might be an example. They sort of like kung fu jiu-jitsu themselves into Hillary Clinton being Secretary of State. You know,
that's interesting. We'll I mean, you think of that as a kind of too clever... you know, kind of thing that could be like sort of these kind of the supreme confidence that derives from having...
Yeah, we'll see. You know, it could be great. I think the thing about her is that everything that he said about her in the primaries is still true. She still doesn't really have foreign policy experience.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean she'll be bad. She's a quick study. She's very smart. She wants to do a good job. You know, I mean, I think those are important qualifications right there. She knows how to listen to people. She has, and I think she's learning the hard way who not to listen to. So we'll see. You know, but I think that's much riskier move than I think the people sort of the conventional wisdom.
I won't ask you this kind of point blank because obviously that's weird. But like, I mean, when you think about, you know, kind of the economic downturn, not so much in terms of inflation rates, but how it will kind of shape the trajectory of kind of the people that you know kind of know and are close to, and how that fits into a kind of wider American story. What are the first things that come to mind, or have you even been thinking in those terms? Because I'm like obsessed with my generation, so that's like all I can think about.
Wow. That actually is something that you might be the difference between maybe you really aren't Generation X. I am not obsessed with my generation. And I have been more obsessed with figuring out like if my husband and I are going to be able, like what we need to do to be able to continue to pay our mortgage and save money for retirement and whatnot. That honestly has been my consideration. And, like, being great, like, we own a house and sort of thinking, like, are we, you know, is that going to be turned out to be a good thing that we bought a house 2 years ago? I think we're going to be okay. I'm very much more focused on, I guess, I don't think it's necessarily selfish.
Yeah.
I think it's probably more typical. I'm also concerned in the sense that it does get beyond me about, you know, I work and live in a media political environment. And the media is not very healthy right now. on any number of different, you know, metrics to measure it by. And so that's a concern. A lot of my friends are looking to get out of media, and I think that if smart, good people, if covering politics and being journalists in general ceases to be an attractive option to smart, good people, that's a bad thing.
I think of it definitely, I mean, in this kind of psycho-generational way that I think about many things. I definitely think of, you know, when you graduate during a recession, I think of people that I know who graduated in 07, 08, and the wage scarring effects that it has. I graduated during a recession, but then also just in terms of the way that you have a bunch of different cycles that seem to be kind of crunching at the same time. For example, you know, if let's say you're in Slavic languages and literatures, I mean, you have this hyper-production of PhDs, and then now you have this kind of paring back that probably was going to happen regardless, but then the shrinking of endowments at elite universities accelerates this process. So, like, a lot of these kind of weird contradictions and weird lacunae, or, you know, there are all these people that I know who, you know, went to get MFAs, et cetera, sort of, you know, going to film school, and they had no expectation, or they were pretty realistic about how this would translate into, you know, kind of realistic job prospects. But now, like, that's a kind of universalized condition that, you know, will have to be true if people go to law school as well.
Well, at least your friends who went for MFAs were being realistic about it and didn't have a prospect.
Exactly.
Who went
exactly.
MBAs
exactly.
In the past 2 years.
Exactly.
Didn't thought they were making
one
really
of my
smart
really good
decisions.
Friends, you know, he went to, yeah.
It's hard for me to really feel bad.
Oh, yeah, and I think that actually, like, I don't, you know, and again, I think that they actually were the ones who actually were kind of tough enough to be like, you know, screw it. I mean, this is something that I want to do, yeah. And I know that I'm going to live in poverty long before the Depression hit. So then, you know,
right.
One of my friends, he's a playwright who, you know, kind of went to Lambda, and then, you know, now he's going to business school. And it's just like, you know, kind of a very kind of funny, you know, universe for him.
Well, we might get much more interesting business.
Yeah, I mean, actually, that's the hope.
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, when people who could have the option of going into a so-called creative profession, and I'll include
yeah.
journalism there, decide to enter the real world of work, and I use air quotes again. Who knows what we? I mean, that actually might be that could be good for American entrepreneurship. I mean, could be good for American business. The more that you have, like, your best and brightest, not, you know, choosing to do something beyond.
Yeah, I mean,
like,
they always say that, you know, these are the moments, like, you know, Google took off after the kind of dot-com bust, et cetera. I mean, obviously the world is very different. You have a kind of systemic risk situation, et cetera. But I think that the prospect of kind of new kind of resilience and creativity, and also just, I mean, you know, it's the whole issue when you look at the inequality landscape of, you know, the income effect dominating the substitution effect, the opportunity cost for the kind of affluent has become kind of so high that, you know, people become workaholics and, you know, kind of wonder why. And so in a weird way, I sense this kind of weird relief from this, and again, we're talking about a narrow, narrow slice of the population, but from some of these people that, like, wow, okay, so, like, my expectations have blown up, and this could actually create a more interesting world where the opportunity costs are somewhat less high, so I actually have the freedom to kind of not screw around, but, like, you know, kind of, but, you know, of course, you know, I kind of think that now, and, you know, kind of when I'm on a breadline, you know, kind of a few weeks from now.
Well, I mean, I think what you're saying, I mean, I think I tend to agree with it. It's good for people to have incentive to get real jobs. Sure. You know, for one thing, it cuts out the number of people that are just screwing around with journalism or screwing around with film school and narrows that down to a pool of people who really want to make films and who really want to be journalists. Because I can tell you, I lived in San Francisco during the dot-com boom and bust, and when I was there during the boom, right before the boom, and I ran into so many people who had come to San Francisco basically just to screw around, and that bothered me. You know, like, I'm going to come here. For some reason, everybody went to Wesleyan. I'm here from Wesleyan, and I'm just going to get a job at a coffee shop. And
weirdly, one of my really good friends is a Wesleyan alum who moved to San Francisco, and the reason we're friends is that we're homonyms. Her name is the same as mine, but she spells it with a Y, and I spell it with an I. So that's just a kind of Wesleyan San Francisco story for you, and also a story about homonyms.
Okay.
But I, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I actually kind of, you know, one kind of vague hope that I've had about the kind of Obama years, or also about this kind of idea of an economic reversal, is that hippies would come back. And, yeah, I mean, weirdly, because I was actually thinking about, like, when you're talking about people coming to San Francisco to screw around, I was thinking about, like, Milk, and thinking about how, okay, those people were actually fleeing intense bigotry and discrimination, but this kind of crazy alternative universe that kind of emerges when, you know, there's straitened circumstances, or when we as a culture have kind of spaces for people to be radically creative and weird. And I think that, you know, it's funny, the relationship of, like, prosperity to that, or is there, you know, I always think of, like, people, all of these people who are doing things like renouncing all material possessions and hitting the road. This was not a large number of people, but New York Times readers were fascinated by it because, wow, that's, like, really interesting, and it is this interesting counterpoint to the kind of intense materialism of the kind of people otherwise read those newspapers.
Isn't that more interesting, like, when times are good?
Yeah, no, exactly. It's more interesting when times are good, but you wonder, I mean, is there actually, like, a real kind of post-materialist sensibility that, you know, kind of could emerge in this universe?
I don't think that America is ever post-materialist in a real way.
See, I think that, like, we've had, I see what you mean, and there's also, like, sort of, you're kind of down with the kind of Baffler gang and the whole kind of conquest of cool school of thought.
I am, that's what we consider ourselves to. We have, like, gang signs. I'm showing right now, again.
And, like, you're actually wearing matching denim jackets with, like, Tom Franks.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Or pleather, or, like, red vinyl in my case, although I'm not in the gang. But and certainly, you know, I get that the way that kind of what looks like a post-materialist moment becomes translated into commercial
into
culture.
Material,
like, at a kind of, but, like, I kind of, you know, I guess I kind of see, you know, kind of there are strands even within what was the kind of, you know, kind of evangelical revival. And also, like, but I kind of wonder, because, well, honestly, I just like people who are the children of hippies. So I kind of want there to be hippies so that if I ever have children, they could, like, smooch with the children of hippies.
Yeah, I guess.
So, like, that's kind of
I don't
what
know
I'm thinking.
If hippies are the cost I'm willing to pay for the children of hippies.
That's a really good point. I just remember reading, like, New York Magazine had this lookbook of this woman who was a prop stylist with her baby, and she was just talking about how she sewed a fur lining on her hood, and I was thinking, this is the most perfect person who ever lived, and I wish that I knew how to sew.
You can learn how to sew. You don't need that woman to exist for you.
I guess you're right, but, you know, it's just sort of, like, it really charmed me.
Relatively, like, you know, it's a relatively simple proposition.
Will you teach me how to sew, Anna?
I send you some YouTube some instructables.
I think that was a real burn right there. I don't know. I'm feeling kind of sad. So tell me about, like, the political landscape. Like, what have you found interesting? I mean, is there anything that's been particularly arresting to you? Or as someone who, you know, you've had this amazing experience of America writ large. Nebraska, Chicago, San Francisco during the boom and bust, Washington. I mean, tell me, like, politics.
Tell you politics. That's not an open-ended question or anything.
I'm actually jazz handing right now.
You know, here is my feeling about the upcoming administration and politics writ large, which is that that I think Americans, when we said change, we actually really meant change just in terms of competency. I mean, this is something that the McCain campaign held on to, you know, for dear life during the election, which is that we are by nature a conservative country. And I think that is true. We are not politically conservative. We are just, for a nation that was founded on this great radical idea, we still tend not to want things to change very quickly. You know,
that radical idea was actually a love of hemp.
That's right.
Which people don't often understand.
That's right.
I get off my hemp soapbox.
If only we still had that love of hemp. Maybe that with the new hippies that'll be coming, that'll all work out. I think that you know, sort of this very premeditated, very cautious sort of rollout that Obama's doing in terms of policy and the personnel he's picking, and if not in terms of how quickly he's doing it, which is pretty radical, I think that we're not. I don't think we're going to see a lot of radical changes in policy or in politics. I mean, I think that the fact of a black man as president of the United States is pretty radical in and of itself. And I think that also the idea of simply having a functional government that doesn't, you know, commit war crimes or torture people or let people drown or, you know, any of the other massive screw-ups you can lay at the feet of the Bush administration, the idea that there just won't be any more of that, that's, like, pretty much what people are hoping for, you know?
I've been having a lot of conversations.
I just don't see on Obama's plate, like, any kind of, like, he's not going to do. His healthcare reform idea is one of the more centrist ones of the Democrats that ran. He's definitely pulling away from the idea of getting out of Iraq on any specific timeline. He hasn't. I guess. I, I mean, He hasn't really presented any firm plans about how he's going to close Gitmo. These are just, there are not a lot of things that seem to be coming forward that are going to be sort of very, they're at least part of a progressive agenda, I'll put it that way.
Not shockingly, have been having a lot of conversations about the kind of center-right universe and how to rethink.
Yeah, how's that going?
I think it's been super interesting, and a lot of what I've been doing over the past couple of weeks is just talking to just dozens and dozens of people, some of them within the right-wing universe, a lot of them, most of them not, and it's a very thorny question. I mean, is this a moment for evangelizing or kind of 30 years of kind of deep thinking, and is it even right to kind of think in terms of the boxes that are familiar to us? I was talking to one person I consider really wise and smart, who was a kind of conservative grandee, who was talking about how, in the late 60s, the public interest, the folks who were kind of clustered around it, you couldn't have predicted where they'd end up 5 years later. One of them, Charles Reich, ended up writing The Greening of America and, kind of becoming part of this hippie-ish, kind of post-materialist, your world, and kind of articulating sort of part of, kind of what, we later associated with, that ideology, if you can call it that. And then some of the others, kind of became pretty traditional right-wingers, and others kind of tried to remain sober, centrist, social scientists or whatever. But I feel like we're in this kind of really interesting moment of flux, and for people like us who are lucky enough to get to kind of chew this stuff over, it's incredibly cool. But I think that, for me, it's just a moment to ask first questions, and I kind of am torn between wanting to do things that are very strategic and tactical because they're interesting, but then also the kind of mix of evangelizing and also just, trying to learn and trying to sense what are going to be the relevant issues in, kind of a decade or two, and like what are the ways we're shaping our economy, and, how that's going to interact with our culture and like family structure and all this stuff, so that, David Frum has this great argument that, conservatism, like progressivism, is kind of over as a political movement, because like progressivism, which was assimilated into both political parties, it had this kind of discrete set of concerns, and then, kind of it sort of kind of addressed them and kind of failed in some ways and maybe succeeded in some other ways. And so then, it's a question of, well, we have this meliorist, kind of liberalism, and the Obama administration is going to be a basically moderate liberal administration. And is there this kind of cluster of ideas, this universe of thoughts that don't fit in that space that, aren't necessarily conservatism? Some things might map onto that. But, kind of where something might cohere that can actually move the conversation forward. And I'm just kind of, that was like really weird, and I'm not sure if it will be explicable to anyone other than the two of us. But
I'm just curious,
I'm fascinated by that.
I mean, I was a teenage activist, and it sounds like actually you think you still are an activist.
I kind of feel like I'm actually just such a fundamentally marginal person that I think of myself as an observer, but I mean, I certainly mentioned learning, and I think that to the extent that there's any kind of activist component, I mean, I am interested in the idea of the Hegelian dialectic, and I'm just not convinced that it's sort of.
The beauty of the Hegelian dialectic is that you don't need to construct an answer,
Simply,
there is a response in the universe,
Yeah, and we have, and we don't necessarily know what it is. My frustration with a lot of folks in my kind of conservative universe right now is that I think that we're going to see a lot of stupid stuff for the next year or two because people fail to reckon with the inadequacy of the kind of set of answers and solutions. And let's kind of radically broaden the solution set, at least while we're kind of, while we have the luxury of thinking and talking, which we'll have for a while. And there's going to be a response to the universe.
I'm just curious. Like, what do you think? I mean, I know you wrote a whole book about this, but is this the moment to? I hear every day, I swear, people telling me that social conservatives are no longer welcome in the Republican Party, or that that's what it should be. That seems crazy to me.
Yeah, I don't think that's even, I honestly don't think that's even an interesting idea, just because it seems so specious, and I think that it also just kind of reflects the narrowness of some of the conversations we're having, because I think that, I take a kind of unfortunately creepily anthropological kind of view of this, but I think that, cultural conservatism in a kind of society like ours is going to have a place. I think it should, and I have a kind of, a lot of gut-level sympathies for it, and I think that it's going to look different, because again, it's a moving target.
I have a theory, which is I think that they're going to become well, as you probably know, like, social Christian right for much of existence was not political.
Yeah.
And I sort of see it becoming a less political institution, or sort of choosing to, especially the new generation of evangelicals, not as interested in electoral politics.
This is, and I think that you have actually followed a lot of this in terms of kind of working on some of your nonfiction projects and looking at kind of younger conservatives. I think that I have kind of mixed feelings because I think that, you know, one thing is just as a raw question of political mobilization, as the country gets more secular, religion happens to be an effective way of mobilizing people because you can kind of narrow cast more effectively, et cetera, just as the unions were, like, effective in the 50s, because you can mobilize a third of the population, et cetera.
That's how they defeated Prop 8.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that, you know, just kind of that kind of, so I think that there's that, so there's the irony of a kind of more secular society could actually make it kind of more salient for political mobilization. But then, you know, to your point, I think that you certainly have this slice of the evangelical population, the kind of cosmopolitan evangelicals, et cetera, who kind of, you know, kind of are oriented toward this idea of kind of building alternative institutions. So that kind of goes back to the idea of a kind of post-materialist sensibility becoming more pervasive. And so, like, I think that I kind of think that that's going to be one piece of the kind of world we're going to see. But I think that, you know, if there's going to be an alternative political coalition to kind of the center-left, I think it's definitely going to have a lot to do. It's going to be redolent with cultural conservatism. It's just going to be like a tricky transition between what does that mean now and what does that mean, you know, in 15 years, and who do you have to jettison, or, like, you know, or, you know, who do you anger in the process?
Right.
But, you know, in terms of, like, sort of the kind of broadening the solution set, it's just, I just sort of think that we have, like, huge, you know, kind of false dichotomies. I remember Paul Glastris of the Washington Monthly was, you know, kind of citing this statistic about how in the 80s, defense procurement overages, you know, kind of cost overruns would be like 7%. Now they're 28%. So when, you know, kind of, you know, Bush and Clinton were like trimming back the federal workforce, they got rid of all these people who knew how to do federal procurement. And so then those people ended up working for the people who presumably were actually racking up those defense overages or something like that. And it's just like, you know, wow, well, that didn't seem to work. So it's like, you know, so I think that, you know, the way that kind of, you know, ideology, and I'm not dismissive of ideology, I think it is valuable and has a place, and I certainly kind of adhere to a kind of whatever classic kind of Hayekian bromides, but, like, what do they actually mean, you know, kind of in this universe we're living in, or if we're going to be in this kind of bull market for politics, you know, that we haven't had for a while, where actually government becomes, like, you know, incredibly active and also valued, you know, kind of how do you make it work? So I think that those are, like, really important questions, and you can't just have the left talking about that or thinking about it, because it's something that, you know, the right has to have coherent answers to. And, you know, Tom Frank, of course, you know, kind of, this is his kind of theory of the conservative looter state. Not, while I don't, you know, kind of buy it hook, line, and sinker, it certainly is something that conservatives need to reckon with and think about.
Yeah.
You know, among many other things. I mean, I actually don't even want to kind of talk about some of my truly kind of crazy ideas, because I fear that I would be locked up in a bamboo cage and lashed. So, you know, I think that, but yeah, but that's,
by Grover Norquist?
Well, you know, he's such a sort of charming fellow.
I like
round people. Tell me about, so you and your husband are both, you know, incredibly brilliant and also incredibly fetching, you know, kind of center-left, kind of left thinkers. Do you guys talk about Gramsci? Do you kind of, like, you're waving a drumstick or maybe a tofu drumstick?
Chickenless nuggets that we have every once in a while. You know, actually, we don't talk a lot about theory and Gramsci, although he did come up the other night, believe it or not.
Oh, cool.
Chris is a much more deep reader than I am in terms of history and philosophy. I am the current events person, and I think that in that way we balance each other out pretty well. To put it just very in the crossest terms possible, the most self-deprecating, like, I keep up with the local gossip and what's going on and, like, the possible appointments and who has what, who knows what about whom, and kind of what the currents and eddies are of the surface of this pond or swamp that we are in Washington.
Yeah.
And he has a much better feel for the depths and the history of the institutions and the history of the ideas. And he is probably better to talk to about most of those things. And you guys should do a blogging head sometimes, probably, although he doesn't blog. Although, at this point, neither do I.
Except that, you know, I've got to say, I just think that, you know, I'm a big Anna Marie Cox fan. Not that I'm not a Chris Layman fan, but
yes.
I kind of feel like...
I'm a huge Chris Layman fan, so...
I'm kind of fascinated by the idea of a kind of... In intellectual couple, because I mean, I imagine if I ever were to get married, it would almost certainly be to a biker, sort of a woman with a kind of death's head tattoo and kind of spinning, whirring blades.
Right.
But she probably would read books.
But you can find bikers
mainly on a Kindle, you know. But
yeah.
that's it. So tell me, sort of, I feel like you are a kind of seer. I feel like you are kind of, you give me the shape of the 21st century. You know, we've talked about Obama. Caroline Kennedy is president in 2016. What do you think about this?
Oh, God. Well, at least she'd have to actually get votes, which I think is the problem with this Senate appointment thing, is that she basically was able to come in and declare her interests and clear out the room, you know? And that, I think, is undemocratic, you know? And I think in general, probably, I think this would be a good time for us to rethink appointments as a way of filling Senate seats in general.
Who would you want? Like,
who would I want?
Is there
I don't
someone
know
that you would
politics,
like
but I know enough about Caroline Kennedy to know that she's not experienced. Now, it's one thing if the people of New York decided that didn't matter to
them.
But I don't want just one person to be able to make that call.
You're kind of the William Jennings Bryan of
yes.
Bryan. I appreciate that.
Do not nail me onto a cross of Caroline Kennedy. You shall not crucify New York on a cross of Caroline Kennedy.
I was thinking Bob Rubin. Why isn't his name in the... I mean, that would have like two kind of... You know, Wall Street-y.
Yeah, I think
kind
that
guys,
would.
In the current climate,
I think that would not look
yeah,
very
no,
good.
Yeah, but I find him actually, I like the fact that he has a kind of dark complexion. I feel like he could be a Bengali.
So if you don't keep a woman in a seat,
man.
You keep a minority of some sort.
Yeah,
even if he's not really a minority, but just kind of looks like it.
Or at least, you know, kind of like, sort of. Yeah, I mean, clearly, you know, someone from upstate or
hey,
blah,
Elliot
blah.
Spitzer's free.
That's true, and he does have that fantastic skull. I was talking
right.
to someone who's a forensic anthropologist.
He could replace Chertoff as the Skeletor.
Is Chertoff
in Washington?
What
State.
A kind of that's another guy with a kind of fascinating face. I think that I
trust New Yorkers more on this. I should as someone who's complained about her, I should look into and see who would be better. But my dodge of that question is that it's the people of New York and not David Paterson that should decide.
I grew up in Brooklyn, and I think I should. I think I'm not yet eligible age-wise, but I think I would be fantastic at that job.
Oh, my God. I totally am on board for that.
I mean, sort of,
you don't live in New York.
I don't live there, but, I mean, I have roots. I'm there kind of all
the
time. That's
right. You establish citizenship just as quickly as Hillary Clinton.
Bobby Kennedy, you know what I mean?
That's right. Hillary
Clinton,
Bobby Kennedy.
Sort of,
you know what? That's it. They should get a carpetbagger.
Yeah, I think that would be
enough. It's the carpetbagger. Seat. You're perfect. We have to be actually. Let's see. I think it's younger than president's 35.
Yeah. So
I think it's just 25.
I'm not quite. Yeah. Well, actually, Joe Biden was elected when he was 29. So
yeah.
Like,
I think it's 25.
I think that's the House, and I think the Senate has to be 30.
Maybe.
But like, sort of, I'm closing in. So like, maybe they could get someone to warm the seat.
I could take it.
The problem is that I would have to run on the line of the kind of. Banglo Nationalist Party, or possibly a coalition of the Banglo Nationalists and the Working Families Party. They've been talking to me. I'm not going to lie to you.
All right.
I think that, so, Anna, are you going to run for Senate from Nebraska? Because I understand the Democrats there are far enough.
Well, the seat is open, right? No, I would not. But actually,
did you babysit Conor Oberst?
Conor Oberst would be fantastic. Actually, now that you mention it, that would be fantastic. Bright eyes in 2010.
How did Nebraska become the hippest state in the union? Was it
just that
your,
one little part? It's just
birth?
That one little blue dot.
I guess you're right.
You know, and I'm still from the red part. So. Anyway, I feel like we should wrap this up.
Yeah, absolutely. Anna, it was
not
such a pleasure.
Not because the questions aren't fascinating.
It was such a pleasure to chat with you.
It is such a pleasure
It's
to
a
chat
real,
with
real honor, sort of, for someone with no hair talking with someone with a kind of, you know, flaming plume.
Yes,
it's
but not very
a...
much of it anymore. I don't know if you've noticed, but I got a haircut. So.
Oh, holy cow. And I also got to see your cat.
Oh, that's right. You will get to see my cat. He made a couple of cameo appearances in the first part. And he is now, well, of course, he's cleaning himself because that's what cats do.
Well, hopefully, sort of, we'll get to do this again at some point.
Or you and Chris. I heartily encourage that. And you for Senate.
Thank you very much, Anna. Right. Talk to you soon. Goodbye.
Right. Bye-bye.